eyes on the prize. That's what I'm reminding myself right now, because there's a lot of juicy news and gossip and stories that could be told right now about the epic collapse of the National Cycling League, the NCL, but that's not what we're about right now. That's a developing story. We are not in the business of talking about breaking news here. We need things to develop. We have to keep our eye on the prize. And that prize right now in this part of the early portion of the season, the stage racing portion of the season, is talking about those big races like Redlands or Gila or Tucson Bicycle Classic that are not criteriums in specific, but are races that happen over a longer distance. Road racing in general, criterium racing is a part of it. We love them both. We love them all. So here we are, keeping our eyes on the proverbial prize, which is to talk about road racing and to talk with somebody who's seen it at various different levels throughout the course of his career, from rank amateur and teenage punk all the way up to UCI Continental Pro, where he is right now on Project Echelon. And of course, we're talking about Matt Zimmer, the man, the myth, the legend, the guy who brought an entire squadron of fans and friends with him to a Grand Fondo, and who is, as of right now, maybe also engaged in defending his honor by being the sweeper in a team time trial event in gravel in Iowa, where he has to catch people who start 2 hours in front of him. He's the guy who has done everything from working hard to being the GC guy to being the person who the GC person relies on. He's seen the gamut, but he's also a working man. He is the same thing as the rest of us, gets up, puts his pants on one leg at a time, goes and does the 9-to-5 job, yet still somehow gets to be a father, gets to be a husband, and gets to be a bike racer. It's a lot of stuff for you to do in any given day, and Matt has done it for the last 12 years, and he's done it all exceptionally well. He is the working man pro, and he's here to give us advice, guidance, nostalgia, structure, everything we need to be inspired by him. Keep the eyes on the prize. My name is Rob Kelly. This is Criterium Nation, a show about life lived one corner at a time. We are a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows. WideAnglePodium.com is the home for the full bevy of shows, the Cyclocross Radios, the Nowhere Fast, the Grodios, even the Slow Ride Podcast. Advice, guidance, rumors, straight from the source. I think that's their catchphrase. Go to Wide Angle Podium, become a member, become a supporter and subscriber. We just went through the entire Redlands weekend where we were covering day in and day out. Also threw in Sonny King. There's a lot of work suddenly, and I've known this for quite some time, that goes into being the media source for all American bike racing. And we really do need your help. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of money to keep the lights on here and to keep things moving forward. Unfortunately, it's no longer just hit the button on the computer, Zoom, and record. There's now different servers and hosting and websites and subscriptions that go into all of the music, and it does add up. We don't ask for advertisers. We don't do much. But if you can, throw us a bone here. Give us a few dollars. Buy us the proverbial beer, whiskey, or coffee. Alan, myself, everybody involved in this would certainly appreciate it. So here we go. We've got an entire episode with Matt Zimmer talking about how it all gets done, looking at how they did it in Europe, looking at ways that we can make it better here in the United States, and how you can make it better in your own houses.
My name is Matt Zimmer. I'm currently in Des Moines, Iowa. And I race for the Project Echelon Racing Team.
One of the things, Matt, that I really enjoyed recently was the Project Echelon Gala weekend down in Tucson, Arizona, in beautiful Oro Valley.
Oh, yeah.
That's, yeah, O-R-O Valley. Make sure that they get all the plugs because they funded part of your weekend down there.
Yeah, it was epic. It went way better than I was expecting. And it was, I didn't think I'd be underdressed at the gala wearing a suit coat, no tie, dress pants, dress shoes, but I was. It was a black tie affair for sure.
There were definitely women in full length cocktail gowns, and they took the gala part of it very, very, very seriously.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I came in a suit and tie and, you know, perfect blue on blue matching because it's Project Echelon, right? You've got to look the part.
Yep, exactly.
And then you've got somebody like Tyler Stites who gets up there wearing his, team issued cycling socks. I found that to be my favorite part of the whole thing.
There's zero chance that guy owns any dress socks, dress apparel. I mean, half the team had to go to the Oro Valley Salvation Army and get clothes to wear because they didn't know it was like as formal as it was going to be. So there's like Ricky's wearing a bolo tie, like Tyler's wearing cycling socks. Like it went exactly as expected it to go.
But one of the comments that you made when Frankie Andreu brought you up and gave you an opportunity to talk was about how you being one of the more senior guys on the team was basically a cycling senior citizen and you might as well be drawing AARP benefits. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I don't think I put it that grim. I think I just said I was in like the twilight of my career, and to be full disclosure, Ricky is older than me, so he's the oldest one on the team, and he's been on the team like a year longer than me, so we should be roasting him. But yeah, no, Frankie was asking me like what my goals were and what I was trying to get out of the season, and you know, like the typical questions you'd ask somebody coming into, like, you know, your coach would ask you, or what somebody outside of, you know, your team that follows you along in your career would ask. And mine was just like, I'm here to like help these guys as much as I can. Hopefully we push, you know, two or three guys to that next level, hopefully next year or the year after. And I just want to like try to provide any sort of insight that I still have in the sport and try to contribute to help those guys like have more success.
And for total transparency, you're like, what, 30 years old now?
Yeah, race age 30. Yeah, I turned 31 next month. So, which is crazy, because if you would ask me and I was 19 when I like first got into this, if I'd still be racing at 31, I would say hell no.
What did you think when you were 19 and you're that young punk in Des Moines who's, you know, cutting his teeth at the local training crit? You know, did you think 11 years or 12 years later that you'd be on a UCI Conti Pro team?
Well, no. But the landscape was so different back then that, you know, like most guys were turning pro in the U.S. domestically, you know, at what, 22, 23, 24. Like now it's like, man, if you haven't made it to Europe when you're 21, I don't know how else you get there. Like, look at some of the guys on our team. We got like Tyler, we're just talking about him. He's like one of the top riders in the entire North American circuit, including the world tour guys. He's up there. He's just as good as those guys winning, but he's doing it without the support that they have. And so I think, you know, back then there was so many domestic teams, like what was there, 7 or 8 at least, plus a few pro Conti outfits still in the US. And now there's just like us and Skyline. So the landscape is so different that back then I was like, oh yeah, I've got time. And now it seems you just have to rush. And I would have never have thought, you know, being in the sport at this age that it would look the way it does. But I kind of just like rode out all these storms between like the cycling scene diminishing in the US a little bit, some events going away, teams folding, and then COVID kind of delayed stuff. And now we're kind of seeing the repercussions of all of that now.
It's not all gloom and doom.
No.
But it definitely is like you have to be a survivor to make it through 2024.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting kind of thought process for Project Echelon as a whole, because not only has it been the team that's survived, it's been the team that's grown. This is the second year UCI Conti. This is your third year or something doing some kind of a overseas campaign. You know, and now you're the guy who's got to help explain to somebody like Laurent or, you know, Ethan or Cade, you know, this is how you go through customs. This is how you pack your bike so that the Spanish police don't interrogate you for 30 hours holding you in a small cell in Valencia. You know, what has been that type of change for you?
Most of the guys have at least raced internationally a few times before joining the team. So that's like, that part's not bad. It's more so, it's hard when you go to Europe because you just hear all the grim stories of like, oh, everyone goes to Belgium and they quit after a month because it rains and they get their doors blown off every day and they realize they don't know how to race a bike. But for us, it's been kind of inviting. Like the first year we went to France and Belgium, we had pretty good weather. We got into some one day races that, you know, it's definitely a shock, like all, but I think everyone took it positively where they're motivated to come back and do something better the next year rather than like, oh, I don't belong here. I shouldn't be here. I just want to go back to the US and race, you know, in parking lot crits and call myself a pro. So it's definitely different on that front. And then it's just the intimidation factor. You know, you're going against guys that, like my biggest fear, the first time we went over and are getting into some of these races where there's, you know, half the field's world tour guys, you're like, what happens if I make a mistake and I crash out some dude making like $1 million a year riding his bike? Like I would feel so bad. So like you kind of have a little bit of that in your like thought process as you're taking turns and ripping descents. And, but eventually you just get used to it and they just, you know, you're just another cyclist out there. It's not that big of a deal.
Has there been an increase in the level of respect that's been given to Project Echelon over the last couple of years? As you know, last year you won a KOM at the Challenge Majorca. You know, this year Scott McGill has found himself on multiple podiums, as has Cade and Tyler. You know, and this is against teams like FDJ or UAE and like legit World Tour, see them on TV teams, that you're doing this. Has the level of respect increased?
It's funny you ask that, because what I noticed is the hierarchy of the sport, you don't see it on TV, you know, like, oh, those, like the best guys are at the front. And you just assume they're just the strongest and that's why they're there. But like, I like trying to explain it to guys here in Iowa when they're like, well, can you guys just like ride up next to them? You're like, well, for a little bit until it gets like, they're actually racing, then pretty much it literally feels like the whole field's working against just us. When really everyone's just trying to take up their own space and protect, you know, whoever their protected rider is for that day. And with us in Valencia, for instance, we were one of two continental teams. So everyone else was either World Tour or Pro Conti. And so, you know, most of these teams have, let's say, $3 to $60 million budgets. And the hierarchy was interesting because you would think the World Tour guys wouldn't put up with any of our shit. It would just kind of be like, they're going to do their thing. They're going to dictate the race. And then we're like collateral damage. Like once those guys go hard, we're like the collateral damage of the guys getting like totally dropped and destroyed most of the time when those guys are just racing each other. And they actually were like they're usually like the nice guys, like willing to help and like, let you know if like your teammate crashed. And like when Ethan crashed in Valencia, that like half those guys came up to us like, hey, like, is your teammate okay? Like we saw him hit the ground super hard here. So like, is he good? And like, yeah, like, thanks for asking. Like he's right behind me. If you want to go chat with him, he's covered in bandages. He looks like a mummy. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have the Pro Conti guys, the step in between us and the World Tour guys. And those guys are like the assholes. Like anytime you got near them, they'd start screaming at you. You're like, dude, we're literally going straight. And there's like 200K left. Like you're fine. And so I think it's the whole, like, they're trying to move up a level. They have so much at play and at risk versus the World Tour guys already there. And then there's just like us riding at the back. And, you know, we'd try to move up when we could and they'd let us ride the front when it didn't matter. But then once it got hard, it was just so hard to stay organized as a team. And those guys are just so much stronger that it was like almost impossible. So hopefully, I think next year, it'll be interesting to see how next year goes, because those guys have like been kicking ass since Valencia. Like I left. They went to France. Tyler was sprinting against Mads Pedersen, who won like every stage of that race they did. And like the fact that he is in that group of like six like all those guys see that. Like everyone at the race knows what happened. They watch the race replays in their hotel after they're done eating dinner and getting massages. So I think there will be a better level of respect. And then to keep rambling on, they just got done with Alentejo, a Portuguese 5-day stage race. And Eric actually got a guy reached out that was at Valenciana who used to be a former pro, and he bought a humongous bus, like all the World Tour buses. And his new like business ventures, he rents it out to Conti teams. And he reached out to Eric and was like, "Hey, I saw you guys in Valenciana. You had some serious results and you were there with like 3 rental cars. Like I own a bus. I'd love to help. It's not that much money. Are you interested?" And Eric said, "Yeah." So having that, I heard from Ozzy, the mechanic, that like the guys must've been chatting about how they're getting more respect. And it's the classic, you're not showing up in 3 rental cars. And you know, we have Gord as a directing those races who, you know, I'm sure he knows tons of those other World Tour directors from being with Israel Premier Tech in the past. So the combination of like his ability to get us more visibility and then the bus, like, it's just like little things like that I think are going to make a big difference down the road for the guys, like probably next year. Maybe we'll even see it later this year.
It's the aggregation of marginal gains, at least fundamentally reputational. I remember when I went to, it was the Vuelta, when it was one of the first years that it finished in Madrid on the circuits. And I think it was the first year that they had done a women's race in conjunction with the men's race. And I got there in time to see the women's race. And these women are racing their hearts out. And you look over on the side of the road and there's like a camper. And, you know, like a conversion van with a metallic sticker on it for this team. And then 30 minutes from the finish of their race, you know, Cannondale shows up with 3 coach buses. And, you know, Sky back then had, you know, massive amounts of funding. And all these teams just showed up with like what looks like what you expect the world to look like when it's professional. And so it's very interesting that the haves and have-nots, you know, that it translates to not just the spectator and the fan looking at it, but it's also to the people who are in the race.
Yeah, it's insane. The fact that, you know, a team with less than $1 million budget is racing against like UAE, who has what, 60 million or whatever it is, like something insane. Like they show up, like if we're eating dinner at the same hotel as them, they'll have like 5 tables of staff. Like they'll have like 30 staff, and we have like, on a really good day, we'll have like 5 staff, which is a ton. I mean, there's 7 riders, 2 mechanics, 2 Swannies, a director, maybe another Swanee or a bus driver. Like that's a lot. Like in the US you would never see that, but over there it's like totally normal because it's every day is just hectic. They're long. There's multiple feed zones. The roads aren't as convenient as they are in the US. So you like really need, like you see the benefit of that where like just having your laundry done, like it's super, you just get pampered, you know, but it doesn't feel like it in the moment because the racing is so stressful. Like you wake up, you eat, you have an hour transfer to the start of whatever stage, you race for 5 hours. The first thing you do is get recovery. And then if you're packing into a rental car, like, and it's a 2-hour transfer back, like it was in Valenciana one of the days, like all those guys are already showered in their buses. They've already eaten dinner and they're like full recovery mode versus we're just like packed in a van. And, you know, probably there's a rider that just raced that's driving. So it's really interesting that it's cool that cycling gives you that insight of being able to race those guys at that level. Cause that'd be insane. Could you imagine somebody who plays like arena football playing the Chiefs who won the Super Bowl? Like that's insane. That would never happen. But in cycling, it's like just another race.
I got to sit in on about 10 seconds of one of your meetings. And it was this conversation about how the riders need to take the support. You need to take the help that is being given to you because you are now professionals. And so Whereas, like, it's a point of pride for me that I know how my bike works and I can wrench on my own bike and I know how to make food in theory and, you know, do all the things that I need to do in order to survive 10 days of racing at Intelligentsia or Toad or whatever it happens to be. But all of those little steps that I have to take as a master's bike racer, you shouldn't be taking because that's decreasing your performance. That's decreasing your capacity to compete against the Ineoses and the Caja Rurales and all of those teams because they're taking the help. They've got people who, that's their job, is to help you.
Yeah, which is weird, though, because from where the team was just 3 years ago, like the minute you start paying people, I think it changes the dynamic. Like once riders are getting paid and staff's getting paid, it's not just like somebody's friend who works at a bike shop that's like showing up and getting paid $100 a day to be there and they're just happy to be there. So like, you know, they're not a race mechanic. They don't know what to expect. Like it's easy to get caught up in the moment of the stress of the race and the situation. Like let's say that you get a flat and that they change the tire and it takes forever. Like you're like pissed at them, but it's like, it's just, they're just doing their best. And I think almost everyone on the team comes from a background of, you know, when you first start racing, you're just like in college or just after college for me, where you're just doing it with friends and driving across the country in somebody's car, like just trying to like maybe get a result that next weekend and gain experience to like progress your career. At that point, it's just a glorified hobby. So I think a lot of that happens at this level where, yeah, we're expected to compete to a point against those teams, but without having those resources, it's really hard. Like you're, you know, if you don't have a coach, most of these guys, it's probably $400 or $500 for a really good coach each month. But if you're only making 10 grand a year, like, and you're trying to eat right, you've got a gym membership. Some guys have nutritionists, like it's like you need that support that the World Tour guys have, but you just don't have the resources to do it.
So let's talk about support and the difference between the United States and what you've experienced in Europe. And I'm going to get the comments from the race promoters from this bit, you know, about how teams want everything and they want the sun too. And I don't want this to be a look at that's not how they do it in Europe sort of thing, but it's also an aspirational thing. We are building a community here, and we need to look at what the truly legitimately professional athletes are doing. So when we talk about the kind of environment behind the European racing versus the environment behind the United States, it's not to say that any particular race in the US is doing it poorly. It's more like this is what we're aiming for. So when you did Mallorca this year, and you know, when the team is at the Volta, the 2.2 in Portugal, you know, famously, Eric Hill, the team owner, has said that it is less expensive for him to send the riders to Europe than it is to race races here in the United States. So all he is really paying for is time and travel. Hotels are covered. Race entry is non-existent. Food is covered in certain instances. What is it like showing up like you did this year at a 5-star hotel for the race?
Yeah. First off, I think it's hard because in the US, just the cost of permits and police, that puts them already like they have a gun to their head, basically. Like, how are you not going to charge $400 for a 5-day stage race? Which sounds like it sounds like a lot of money until you picture like how much of these national level crits are $70 or $80 to ride around in circles for 60 minutes. And if you win, you're not going anywhere. No team's picking you up. Like it's sweet. Probably win like $4,000 or $5,000 in prize money, but it's not like a result that's going to mean anything in Europe. Cause it's not a race that anybody over there would recognize. But going back to the Europe side of things, a lot of it's just government funded. So like this race we're going to do in France later this year, the government wants, like they want a US team there because of the tourism we would bring. So being a US based team has its perks because US typically, you know, as a nation, we have more disposable income. We're going to take more vacations. So if, you know, you tell 30 of your buddies you went to France and it was super cool and rode your bike and hung out in Paris, like that means something. And what are the chances one of them goes? So they put in tons of, you know, tourism board has chipping in to get teams like us there. And that's kind of what happened with the fallout of Joe Martin is the tourism board dropped the race and that's why they failed. It's a $100,000 deficit that they're trying to make up and they were given 10 days to do it. And so that's never going to happen, like, which is terrible because that's an iconic race, but hopefully it comes back next year. But yeah, showing up in Europe where basically we're just paying to get there and paying for rental cars and Airbnbs in between races that, you know, if there's a week long gap, we're going to go stay somewhere for a week. It is way cheaper than just traveling in the US alone. Like my flight to California for BWR San Diego is going to cost almost as much by the time I check my bike bag, probably Uber from the hotel or from the airport to the race hotel or whatever, or team member picks me up and sits in traffic for 2 hours. Like it's almost the same cost as flying to Europe, as long as it's planned out ahead of time. So once you get there, the cost implications are way less because you just have a rental car, Airbnb. Once you get in that race bubble, you know, they're providing the hotels, they're providing, sometimes they will provide race cars depending on the level, like your follow cars. Like if it was like Valencia is a double caravan, so you can have two caravan cars. They don't expect a team like us to show up from the US with two caravan cars. So sometimes that's an option where they'll help you with that. So yeah, once you're in that bubble, I don't know how much money gets spent by the team, but it can't be very much compared to going and buying groceries every day for Redlands. I mean, that's a week of groceries.
One of the things is, and you point out the tourism aspect and the kind of the coattails of Project Echelon. And I just want to bring a real like learning point here is with the team gala came a golf event and also the ride the next day, the Grand Fondo. And you brought with you how many guys from Des Moines?
I think half the Grand Fondo was guys from Des Moines. There's actually supposed to be more that were there, but they, what happened? Somehow like six of them couldn't make it, but they were in town. I don't know what happened. They had other friends join them or whatever, but there was probably like 15 to 20 guys from Des Moines or Iowa in general.
And that's random people from Iowa showing up in Arizona to a local tourism board that's not exactly huge, or a chamber of commerce that's not exactly huge, filling hotel space, filling restaurants, buying all of the Coors banquet beer from the mid-ride water stop, because that's
that did happen.
That's Iowa for you. And then finishing the ride off with Bud Diesel's. I mean, it's just that amount of money that you start to see incrementally flowing in. And it's heart-wrenching and crushing to know that Joe Martin was postponed this year, did not happen this year because the state of Arkansas's tourism board, you know, sacrificed $100,000 from its budget because it just couldn't cover it. And, you know, behind the scenes, a lot of human beings were impacted by that and tried to cover that gap. So, you know, like I think that somewhere around 65,000 of the 100,000 was actually eventually located, but it's still like $45,000 is a lot of money to a bike race. I just don't think that people necessarily understand how far and wide coattails for a team like yours, a team that's got a following, a team that's got results, that has smart marketing and has people coming with it, like how far that goes and why it's, you know, important for the Sunny Kings of the world or the Gilas or, you know, Redlands to continue to exist for these communities.
Yeah. And it's interesting because Gila, they signed a 5-year deal with the New Mexico Tourism Board. So like they're safe for 5 years. So if you picture that race has always been on the fritz, like every year there's the rumor like, yeah, Gila's not happening. And you're like, from who told you that? And you're like, okay, well that kind of has some traction. Then somehow it happens. And the fact that Joe Martin was the opposite end of the spectrum this year, where that was what they lost. And in the timely manner they did, it wasn't like they had 3 months to figure it out. They had a week. So it's super sad that that's the reality of the cost that it takes in the US. But I actually want to have a episode with Eric on the Sticky Bottle podcast where I want him to, he's been open to it. I think he said he would do it ? But just talk about our budget and how we use it. Because I think from the outside, people see us as like, you know, it's the haves or the haves not in cycling. Like we go to race with TT bikes and it's a problem because the other team doesn't. You're like, well, how is that my fault? Like the race allows TT bikes. Why would we not bring them? And so there's like that whole issue in the US and cost of traveling, and it's an expensive sport and every race seems to be on either end of the coast. So you're just always traveling for these races. And so I want to do an episode where we talk about what we actually do with the money we have. And I think it will inspire other teams to realize how far you can go with, like, we don't have a ton of cash, but we're going to do 40 or 50 race days in Europe by the end of this season. We're going to do all the big stuff in the US. We're going to venture into some gravel stuff. So like it can be done. It doesn't have to be this whole like, all right, everyone on the team needs to be paid 50 grand. Okay, well now what do you do when you have $500,000 just to cover salaries? Like that can't happen. Like you have to be realistic with how you're spending that money. And Eric's been almost too frugal in the past with spending, but this year he's like, you know, way more open to, and last year, I guess too, to like videographers, spending more money on the marketing stuff. Cause like that stuff does matter. Like that's the ultimate content that people are seeing. And so like that race in Portugal last week, it wouldn't have meant anything if there was no post about it. No one would even know unless you're on Pro Cycling Stats wandering around. You see Scott McGill going top five every single day. Like you wouldn't know. So it's like a whole different world.
The social media marketing component of it, the videographers, the photographers, all of those people who are out there making us look actually good is
or bad,
you know,
there's lots of meme accounts now that are just roasting everybody nonstop, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, I guess that's when you kind of know you made it, when you get roasted by Crit Beef, or you know, you get roasted by Office Park Crits or something like that. Like
funny you bring up Crit Beef, because Eric always likes all their stuff from our team page, and finally they message back and they're like, we're not posting stuff about you anymore. He's like, why not? He's like, because you actually think, like, you actually like respond and like it, like we're trying to stir the pot. He goes, and Eric's like, yeah, it's because it's funny. Like this is good stuff. Like it's good for the sport. And if you can just take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah. But like that photo from the Volpa of Ethan lining out the whole team with other recognizable jerseys behind is well worth the amount of money that was spent on all the photographers during the course of the year. I mean, just that one opportunity will be marketed all over the place for everybody, because it's like, we are six deep pro here. And it's just phenomenal that we as a sport continue to forget the value of selling ourselves to the community. You know, we need them much more than they need us. You know, Des Moines would probably be better suited having a 5K on a Friday night in the Arts District than it would ever be of having a bike race anywhere within the county. But yet, if we continue to tell people, look at how good we look, look at how pro we look, look at how much we are bringing to your community, it's something that might actually eventually stick.
Yeah, it's funny you say how pro we look, because I think that's almost like an issue in the US, is like everyone's caught up in having like all the nice stuff and not actually doing a lot of the work. And there's this like facade about, I don't know what it is, where like just saying you're a pro cyclist sounds bad. Like, I don't consider myself a pro. Like, yeah, I'm on a continental team, but we're a Division III team. Like, I guess in the US it's pro, but in Europe it's not, you know? So it's just like that. It's that weird situation where no one knows what to call themselves, and they're not in school. They're not working. They're going to Tucson in the winters and training. Like, I did all that. And so I think it's all about like the facade of looking pro. And it's hard because I think the sport is, it's hard to see like the intimate side of it. You know, you just see like, oh, that was really hard, I bet. Like, but you don't actually like see what goes into that. And, you know, you have giant sunglasses on, you can't see anyone's eyes. Like, it's becoming like robotic very fast in the last 3 or 4 years, as you can like watching the tour. Like, nobody wants to have dinner with Jonas Vingegaard. Like, he looks like he probably doesn't talk and just rides his bike and only thinks about his bike versus being like a real person behind the bike racer. And I think that gets kind of lost, but I think social media can help with that, but it also kind of steers it in the wrong direction too, sometimes with just in the US with opportunities that we have. So it's just an interesting dynamic.
Well, we'll be opening the OnlyFans account up very soon, and we'll be taking $10 a subscription for all of
tan line picks.
Yeah, all of the Ethan Crane tan line picks, helmet tan line picks. Those are my favorite.
Our team would be, we'd have a bigger budget if Ethan was doing that.
So let's talk about, as a main topic, kind of this concept of the pro lifestyle. Because 2 years ago, so actually 2023, I got the opportunity to come down to Tucson for a few days with you guys and see what it was like. But in the first day, you know, I went and met Sam Morris and Will Hardin, who were on your team at the time, and Zach Gregg, who's still on the team, at the apartment that they were renting, or team was renting with them, that the team was getting a deal on, because it was not habitable. Let's just put it like that. There was a wall that was completely missing. There was a 2x4 that was somehow providing some sort of structural support. It's not a sexy, glamorous life.
No, it can't be. There's not enough money in the US to make it glamorous. Like, how would you, unless you're independently wealthy or like doing something that allows you to make 80 grand a year and work 3 hours a day remotely, I don't know how else you would do it. Especially in the US, it's so big. Most people can't train where they live year round. So like you're forced to, you know, spend $300 a month and split it five ways for $1,500 rent with your buddies and go live in Tucson. And like, you're not going out to eat. That's for sure. You're not buying fancy coffee. Like, you're just there to train and buy a gym membership.
We did go to the Panda Express. I do remember that after the ride. So that was high quality.
That's serious.
But you are the working man pro. You have a full-time job where you do serious, actual adult work that you fit in a bike racing life at the UCI Conti level, along with being married and being a father, you know, to a young child who has a double ear infection going on right now, yet you still managed to get on the bike tonight. Let me ask you this question as a kind of a prelude. Do you think that the time and opportunity for you to be a world tour rider has gone and come and gone?
Oh, 100%. I had a guy ask me in town at a coffee shop the other day. He was commenting about, you know, following the team when we were in Spain and stuff when I was there. And he's like, yeah, like, is your goal, like, you know, to move up to that like next level? And I'm like, I literally didn't know what to say. I was like, what did you ask? And he's like, are you trying to move up a level? I'm like, no, like, what? I have a kid and a wife. And at the time I had 2 jobs plus the team. I had 3 jobs because the cycling team employs me. So like, no, it's like not my goal. Unless I'm going to get a divorce and never see my kid again and quit all my jobs. Like, that's not even like the fact that he didn't even know that, and his kids both race and are trying to be pros, is just like, tells you the delusion of some of the people in the US with the sport. It's crazy.
Why do you think there is such a disconnect between the real professionals, which the UCI classifies as the Pro Road Tour and the World Tour? Those are the people that have minimum salary amounts. And the folks who show up at CBR, or who show up at the driveway?
This is a super good question. I talk about this all the time with other people. When we just ponder why, because listen, like I always try to relate it to running. Like if you have somebody that runs a 5-minute mile, they're not going to show up to the race on Saturday thinking they can do a 4-minute mile. That would never happen. But in cycling, that happens all the time. Like I had a kid I coached and he got a chance to go to Worlds a couple years ago for the time trial. I'm like, what do you think you can do for this hour effort? And he was off by what he actually did versus what he thought he could do was off by like 150 watts. He was like 40% off. Like that doesn't happen in other sports. Nobody just thinks they're going to like just beat their personal best by 40% or 30%. But in cycling, I don't know if it's, you know, you read all the articles about what power profiles people do and they think like, oh, I just have to lose 5 pounds. And like, oh, I've done that before. And it's like, yeah, but have you done it 17 days into a stage race after going super hard, like 3 hours prior to that? Like the circumstances are always different. It's not just sitting on a trainer and cranking out power like you would in a Zwift race. So I don't know if it's that versus I think you get this perception of you can buy what the pros use. You can buy the ketones, you can buy the drink mix, you can buy recovery stuff. You can literally ride the same exact bike, same sunglasses, same shoes. So I don't know if it's partially that. So I don't know. It's just like a running conversation I have with other people. Like why do people who are Cat 3s that are 25 years old, their goal when they tell you is, my goal is to be a pro. It's like, well, first off, that's not a goal. That's the outcome of a goal. Your goal can't be to be a pro. Your goal can't be to be a millionaire. You have to do something to make the money that you like to do to become a millionaire. You're not just going to be a pro cyclist. Like you got to get results to get recognized by a team. You got to fit in with the team. You can't just be a fast bike racer. So I don't know. Like, what do you think on your end that you see being not in my position in the sport?
I mean, one, I feel like you're preaching from the gospel of atomic habits right there about the goal can't be winning the race. The goal is a much more narrow, simple, defined thing of I want to ride 3 hours today. I want to ride 15 hours this week. That's a goal.
And I only say that because I've heard it 3 times in the last week. Oh, my goal is to be a pro. What should I do? I'm like, well, that's not a goal. Like, there's a really talented kid here in town that's 15. He's like, I just want to be a pro. I'm like, well, that's not a goal, dude. You got to like, there's got to be steps to getting there. It's not just being a pro. Like, cause you don't even know what that entails.
It's also interesting that you bring that up because it's like you talked about the Chiefs. And so you're looking at, you know, how many kids play high school football in the United States versus how many kids make it to the college level? How many of those kids start? How many of those kids even make it to the NFL combine? How many of those men now are drafted and how many of them make the starting lineup for how many years? I mean, the average NFL career is 2.25 or something like that.
Yeah, it's little.
And so you're looking at a very narrow, rare bit of air, but how many of those high school students playing at Des Moines or Ames High School sit there and go, I'm going to be the next starting quarterback for the Chiefs or for the Vikings or whatever it happens to be? And how quickly they get disabused of that idea. Whereas in the CBR world, you know, it's how quickly can I put this on the Instagram of me sprinting against 3 other people?
Yeah. And I think that's a good point, actually, because in cycling, if you look at most people who are good, they were all their hometown hero at some point. You know, they're always that like, oh, that's that 17-year-old kid that showed up to the group ride that can drop everybody. But you're also going against guys that like half the time, you know, they race at like a semi-competitive level, like Cat 3, Cat 2, maybe a couple Cat 1 guys. And so I think you're surrounded, you're in a very small pond from the get-go because you're not doing football. You're not doing something that almost every guy in your class, graduating class, probably played at some point. Like when I graduated high school, I don't think a single other person even owned a bike, like an actual bike versus me. So like right away, I'm technically at the top level of what I could do in my class. And in Iowa, there was only like three other people in my age group anyways. So then you beat them and you're like, okay, well, I'm the best kid in that discipline in Iowa. So I think you're just in a small pond to begin with versus, you know, in Belgium, you go do some of these a Tuesday kermesse or a Wednesday evening kermesse in a town of 400 people. And there's like 180 people signed up. It's insane.
But why continue to do it? You know, because you're not going to make it to the world tour. You know, you're not going to get the guaranteed minimum salary of 44,000 euros a year. You know, why you, as somebody who's got a full-time job, a wife and a kid and a house and a mortgage and a this and a that and all these other very real world big kid things, why continue to do it? You're 31 years old. Shouldn't you be doing something better with your life? I say that with a great degree of irony.
No, that's a good, it's funny because I don't think anyone's ever actually asked me this outright. So I would probably continue. It's been such a part of me for so long. Like my wife, Megan, and I have been together since we were like 17. And from then I was still doing racing. So like, that's like when I first started. So like, it's always been a part of what I've done. And it's the classic like endurance psychopathic like athlete. Like what else would I do? I'd just like shift gears and work more. Like would I just work more? I think so. Or would I just start running? But running doesn't take up that much time. So would it be as fulfilling? Like I still get the, I still like the structure of it. I like the benefit. I like the number side of it. Like it's easy to stare at a power meter. It's quantitative. If you know if you're getting better or worse. And then being on this team, like every year, they just get better and better and better. And being on that boat has been like insane. Like it's Eric's goal is 5% better every year. And I think he's easily delivered on that. Like COVID destroyed half these teams and we like doubled our budget over it.
Oh, if you look at the quality of the kit designs, definitely there's been more than a 5% increase.
Oh God, they're so bad. Yeah. They're like 400% increase when I joined the team in 2019. And then it was still not great. The shield is gone, thank God.
You're a working adult who's still getting his ass kicked by pros. And you keep having a positive attitude about it. How do you maintain the positive attitude about it? Knowing that, you know, you're going to be going up against somebody who this is the only thing that they can manage to do on a daily basis. The concept of changing diapers for some of these people is just foreign. And for you, it's probably like
half the guys on the team.
I would, there's a joke about Ethan changing his own, but, you know, I'll get something from Sabrina for that one. But, you know, it's like, how do you keep going and being like, nope, I need to get up. I need to do this ride. I need to do this ride hard. And I need to, you know, to act the part of a professional, even if I don't necessarily consider myself to be one.
I think it's just always been a part of me, even from like when I raced in college, seeing how many people were there. And it was the classic, what do you know? I'm going to be a pro. Okay, cool. You, me, and the 20 other kids in our cycling like team that are all freshmen are all going to be pros, I'm sure. And then by senior year, like everyone's quit and just like the attrition it takes in the sport. And then I've thought about being done the last 2 years. And every time I think like, did I do all that work to be done now? Or if I have this opportunity to go to Europe still a couple more times and try to help the team, I'm going to do it. And I even told Eric and Isaiah when they were doing roster stuff is like, my biggest fear would be taking a spot from somebody who deserves it. And if they fully think somebody else deserves it, I want them to have it. I don't want to be where I was when I was 24 and hoping to get on a team and seeing all these guys that are in their 30s that are like, this guy's trash. Like he was never good to begin with. So how is he on that team? Like, I don't ever want to take resources from somebody that's up and coming. Like if there's some 20-year-old kid out there that Eric wants to bring on the team, but can't because of resources, I would gladly step down. I've almost done it like three different times for people and they figured it out how to get them on the team instead. because I just don't ever want to take up those resources. Because I've, like you said, I've done what I've wanted to do in the sport or can do in the sport. And now it's kind of just like, just enjoying getting here. I just don't want to take up that opportunity from somebody else.
Because in no way, shape, or form do I want to suggest that you're a bad bike racer. You clearly are one of the strongest bike racers in the United States, hands down. I mean, you have a KOM from a UCI race from last year. So it's not like your best years are that far behind you or even anywhere behind you. And what was it? There was a gravel race where you're the sweeper in Iowa.
That's next weekend. It's coming up, actually.
Yeah, like you race everybody and everybody's got a head start on you or something like that.
Yeah, it's a team time trial format. But to be completely fair, it's like a detriment to have somebody with you. Like, could you imagine riding gravel and having to stick with five people? Like, me being by myself is a huge benefit. Even if I do start 2 hours behind some of these teams, like, they're out there just having fun. So yeah, it's like the hardest day of the year for me, honestly. It's like 3.5 hours of as hard as I can go.
But you continue to do well and you continue to thrive. You continue to find yourself on rosters at big races where the guys you are racing with and for are achieving and succeeding. How do you do this? And I'm going to be taking copious notes because I need to learn from somebody.
Well, to start, I think a lot of it's just the foundation I've built over the last like 10 years. You know, it's the whole, you know, I remember doing like 500 hours of riding the first year I started. I was like, holy shit, that's a ton. And then by my peak, I was doing almost 1,000 hours. And that's with a month off. That's with a couple, you know, 1 week breaks throughout the season of no riding. So it's a lot of time. And so just having that, you know, muscle memory, essentially, it doesn't take that long to get strong and competitive, but it still takes the same amount of time to get as fast. Like, being strong and fast are two different things. And that's where I've noticed I've faltered is the really sharp end of the races. I just like can't do it anymore. Like, I used to feel like I could, but my role is also different where, you know, in 2019 or 2020, I was a GC guy on the team, but COVID hit, I got hit by a car. I had a bunch of setbacks, like no racing happened. And by then I was married and had a mortgage and a full-time job. And it's like, oh, this is cool. Like, I can do both. This isn't that bad. And so I've just been kind of on that plane ever since. And now that we have these guys that are like insanely fast, like we have like 10 guys that can win any stage race. And now that I'm just a support role, like my mindset has shifted a little bit on what I need to do on the bike, at home and off the bike to be successful, to be able to support them. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it.
Talk to us about the at-home part, because for those of us who are married and for those of us who have responsibilities at home, we all realize that $1 of marital capital does not equal $1 in the real world.
No.
So, you know, with Megan, she's very understanding. She laughs at your jokes. I've listened to the Sticky Bottle podcast that the two of you did together.
That was a good one.
And I loved every second of it. And, you know, as a father, you have additional like responsibility that comes with it. So how do you balance the expectations of life at home, life at work, and life as a UCI Conti bike racer?
Waking up early is the key. First off, like, I get a shit ton of stuff done from like 5 a.m. to noon, essentially. Like, family stuff. I cook breakfast every morning for Megan and Jones. I make coffees. Sometimes I'll pack Megan's lunch and get them out the door before I go and work. And I'm lucky enough to have a job where the flexibility, I can leave at 1 or 2 or take a half day and go train and work in the evenings when Jones is asleep. So that's been an adjustment, but it's the whole like when I was just training, all you do is wake up, eat, and then sit around and wait to train. Like, oh, it'll be warmer at noon, so I'll just wait till it's noon. Oh, it's noon and it's windy as hell out. Like, okay, I'll just wait till like 3. Then you wait till 3. And then like, you still spent the same amount of time on my bike. Like, yeah, I can't just go do 6-hour rides, but like, last Tuesday I rode 6 hours and I still worked seven, but you know, I had to sacrifice, like I wasn't home for dinner. Jones, I didn't see him in the evening before he went to bed at seven. So like there are give and takes where now I can't just go to Europe for 2 months versus then I did do it. Like I would go for a month or, you know, 2 months back in like 2019 or 2021, whenever that was. And yeah, I don't see Megan and it sucks, but it's like, we've always kind of had a long-term or long-distance relationship, like in college and stuff. So it's not that like foreign to us. But now with Jones here, and he just turned one, like he turned one at the gala, actually. That was his birthday.
Yeah, he was asleep. I didn't get to meet him.
He was asleep. Yeah, he wasn't even there. So he had a great time. With him now, it's like that he's like the X factor of like now being gone sucks. Like I can see... like when I was in Spain for 2 weeks, like it was hard. Cause like if I felt like so much changed with him so quickly while I was gone, but I knew, you know, Megan and I had talked about it ahead of time. And I talked about it with Isaiah and Eric about if like, send me what you want me to go towards, like go to for races and stuff. And then I'll talk about it with Megan. We'll see if it works. Like I just can't be gone for a month. Like some of those guys were in Europe forever. They were literally there over a month. And so if I can just jump in and do like a week long stage race and come home, like it's not the end of the world. And Megan's super understanding. We've got a good support group here in town that help. Like if Jones needs picked up from daycare, cause Megan's working late, like that, we have that help. So I think that's kind of like the reassurance that I've got and knowing it's not forever. Like this isn't just like, all right, the next 20 years of my life, this is like every summer I'm going to be gone for Memorial Weekend. Every summer I'm going to be gone the last week of July because we're going to be in France for the stage race we've done 10 times. So knowing that, I think there's a light at the end of the tunnel for everybody involved. And that's what's funny because Eric's like, do you think you'd want to be a part of like the management side of things after you're done racing? I'm like, hell no. That's even like, that's the same amount of travel. And I don't even get to be a rider. Like, forget that. Why would I do that?
So I just did 16 days on the road, partially working my job, like actually doing legitimate lawyer stuff, partially being a bike racer, partially just being a tourist and, you know, a beach bum in San Diego and whatnot. And the 3-hour time zone difference between DC and California just like crushed my ability to maintain cohesive relationships and maintain productivity. And by the end of the time, despite working basically 8 hours a day, every single day, I still felt like I was behind. I felt like I needed to come home and I needed to work time and a half just to reconnect with everything. Like, doing laundry sort of thing. You know, how do you manage that when you're doing these blocks where you're just in Europe, in Arizona, elsewhere?
Luckily, I can do my entire job remote if I need to, other than like a couple of things. So for context, I do like all the financials for a construction company here in town. So bookkeeping, controller work, paying bills, entering. Some days it's super tedious data entry. Other days it's like, you know, financial forecasting and stuff like that. So I can do it fully remote. I just need a computer and guys in the field to give me info, and I can pretty much do everything remote. And knowing when I'm going out of town, I can kind of set it up where I just get stuff done ahead of time, or, you know, queue stuff up that's going to need to be done when I get back. But the family side is hard. Like the dishes don't get done if I'm not here. Like Megan has to do that while holding Jones and trying to have some time to herself too. So getting ahead, like that part has always been the tricky part. I don't think I have an answer for how to do it properly. At least I'm still married, so I must be doing it moderately okay.
I mean, all advice is just nostalgia, right? I mean, that's the quote. Nothing's ever perfect, but by God, if the result isn't awful, at least you're doing something.
Yeah, I like to think so.
So where do we go next? What is in store for you for the next couple of years? How much longer do you think you can continue doing it at this level before eventually you break or you move on or Megan breaks or whatever.
I would probably guess this would be probably my last year at this level. I just don't. The time commitment, like, man, cycling's just hard. Like, it's just really hard. Like, there's so many days that aren't fun versus the days that are fun. But the days you do feel good, you're like, oh, this is why I do this. Like, just smashing an interval set, like, you know how it is. It's, like, so satisfying when it goes, like, better than you expected. And, like, you get done and you're like, oh, I could probably do more. I'll hurt myself, but I could do it. So I think you're always, like, chasing that kind of feeling. So after this year, I don't know if I would, you know, if the team would have a need for me to like go to a couple gravel events, hang out with sponsors, like stuff like that, versus, like I said, I just don't want to take up opportunities from somebody else who's trying to progress. Cause like I said, I'm not moving up, but there could be a kid where like this team could be the launching pad for his career. Like it could be a life-changing opportunity. I don't want to take that from somebody. So I think after this year, I'll probably still ride. I'll probably join the Sicari team. You met all those guys, the ones that drink all the beers. I fit right in. I hope they would accept me into their tribe, but we'll see. That's to be determined.
So as far as this year, final question for you, what is it that you are looking forward to the most with the team?
Spain was kind of like my target because I knew, unless somebody gets hurt, like I'm kind of on the fringe for most of the rosters. If we have split squads, I'll get to race. So like that'll happen I'll go to France in July. I'll do a couple of the BWR stuff. We'll do Levi's Fondo because that's the same week as Redlands. So I'll have a split squad. I think those one day races are going to be super fun, especially the gravel stuff with the guys that like, they don't really have expectations or like goofing off, but it's still a weekend away. It's still, you're at a bike race. You have that atmosphere. Like, you're eating a ton of rice. You're just doing the stuff you like did as a bike racer, like growing up and when you first get into it and like not taking it as seriously as you do when you're like in Europe, where if you have a bad day, you're probably going to get time cut versus there. You're like, oh, cool. If I drop my chain or get a flat, I'm going to like ride with somebody and shoot the shit for like 5 hours and it's going to be fun.
Well, Matt, thank you so incredibly much for talking to us about being the working man pro.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the show. We are a proud part of the Wide Angle Podium network of shows, wideanglepodium.com, for the full bevy of shows that are available there. Do not worry, we are going to cover the NCL. We have convened the War Council, the sources of sources, and we are going to look at everything. And we're going to do a special episode next week in which we explore the entire spectrum of things as we know it by this point in time so that you can be ready for your rides the following weekend to talk all about the NCL. So join us here again next time for more stories from our Criterium Nation.